Before we move to the cases to be heard this morning, we have a motion for admission to the bar of this court. The movement is my colleague, Judge Lynn. Judge Lynn?
Thank you, Judge Bryson. I would like to move the admission of Stanley Fisher, who is a member of the bar in good standing of the highest court of Virginia. I have knowledge of his credentials and am satisfied that he possesses the necessary qualifications.
Mr. Fisher, the motion is granted and you are admitted to the bar. And I would invite you to step over to the clerk's station and take the oath. Before you do, I'd like to extend to you a warm welcome on behalf of all the judges to the bar of this court.
Raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear or affirm that you will report yourself as an attorney and counselor of this court uprightly and according to law, and that you will support the Constitution of the United States of America?
Well, I add my welcome, and I know Mr. Fisher quite well, as he has served as my law clerk for the past year and a half and has made a substantial contribution to the work of my chambers, to the work of this court. I'm very proud of what you've done. You've accomplished quite a bit. I look forward to your continuing successful legal career, and we expect to see you at the lectern shortly. Welcome.
Thank you. We have five cases on for disposition today. Three of them will be argued this morning. Two of them will be submitted on the briefs. Before we begin, just for the purposes of telling counsel, in case you're not familiar with the lighting system, that when the yellow light goes on, it means you're beginning to consume your rebuttal time. When the red light goes on, that means your time has expired. In addition, we have, I assure you, read the briefs. We're familiar with the case. We're familiar with the argument. So please, the time is limited, and do get right to the issues you want to call to our attention today. We don't need to have a lengthy exposition of the facts, because we will be familiar with this. Very well, let's begin with the first case, number 05-1354, FlexRest against Steelcase, Mr. Cees. Is that the pronunciation of your name?
It is, Your Honor.
Cees.
Cees.
Cees. All right. Very well, Mr. Cees.
May it please the court, this is an appeal from a jury patent case tried in the Western District. Judge McKeague, the judge now of the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. In this case, the 489 patent was held invalid by the jury. The primary issue involved in the case, particularly because of a stipulation the parties entered into in the middle of the case, where they said Steelcase's products infringe, and in return for that, we said the KBS reads on the claims, and therefore the claims are invalid if the KBS is prior art. The rest of the case was tried upon that premise. Our primary contention here on this appeal is that the so-called KBS, which was a prior device made by Steelcase, and there's no doubt about that, but that it is simply not prior art. It was wrong for it to ever show its face in the courtroom, and it was wrong for it to be before the jury, and it was wrong to not instruct the jury on the issue of suppression and concealment, so that they never had that opportunity to even consider whether the KBS, which was admittedly was secret, was in fact not prior art because it went on to G2. The activities of Steelcase show, and there's a timeline in our brief on page 9, that they reduced to practice this so-called KBS in about November 16th, 1990. And there's laboratory test reports of that. Now, that is before our client conceived in Thanksgiving 1990. The dates are quite close. And the evidence at the trial showed, and every single witness of Steelcase so testified, that it was their objective and that it was their conduct to keep that KBS secret from the time they first had it reduced to practice until when and until why, until the so-called Neocon Furniture Show occurred in June of 1991 in Chicago. There were three primary witnesses on this subject at the trial: Mr. Bruce Preston, the technical manager of services, the inventor of the KBS device, and they got their own patent on their device, Mr. George, and Mr. Musculus, who did the product testing in the testing laboratories in Grand Rapids for Steelcase. And each of those people testified that they understood that they were keeping it secret and that there was to be no revealing of the product until the Neocon show.
What do you think your strongest case is in our precedent for demonstrating that comparable facts are sufficient to constitute concealment?
I think the strongest cases that I have are the Young versus Dvorkin case and the Lutzke. I hope I pronounced
Wasn't that. Lutzke a patent application case?
It was a patent application, and I believe so was Young. I don't think that makes a difference, Your Honor, as to whether or not the activity that we are dealing with on behalf of the first user was the filing of a patent application or was in fact commercialization. The truth is, in this instance, we have both. We have Steelcase timing the filing of their own patent application to May 31st, 1991, just prior to the Neocon show, which occurred in June. And that in spite of the fact that they knew, because Mr. Ambrose of FlexRest had approached them in March and said, I have an idea, I have a pending patent application on file, I in fact have begun selling a product, and I think it would fit in your line, and begin exploring licensing talks with them.
Suppose there were an unreasonable delay in filing a patent application, but at the same time there was disclosure through a perfectly reasonable course of commercialization, such that by the time the good was brought to the state in which it was prepared for commercial exploitation, that nothing had been done that would count as an undue delay. Would it be sufficient to satisfy the requirements of disclosure under 102G under those circumstances?
My answer, I think, lies in the concurring opinion of Judge Rich in Young versus Dvorkin, where this court has consistently, as I read the cases, refused to say there's any magic time period involved. It, as Judge Rich said in Young versus Dvorkin, it is the totality of the conduct and the intent that is relevant, not so much the lapse of time. And here, the clear issue is that the totality of the conduct was, even mentioned by counsel for Steelcase in her opening statement, of course we kept it secret. You keep the Emmys and the Grammys secret before the show. And that's our point exactly. Now, there's only a seven-month time period here, but it's that seven-month time period where there was active suppression and concealment, timing everything to make sure that it only occurred exactly at the Neocon show. And it was exactly in the middle of that time frame that Mr. Ambrose both conceived of his invention in November of 1990, reduced his invention to practice, filed a patent application, and began sales, and then contacted Steelcase. And to show that there clearly were their intent of not telling anybody about what they were doing, even when Mr. Ambrose went to them in the middle of this time frame and said, I have an idea for you, and he gave him paperwork on it, and he gave him pictures of it, they still didn't say anything about what they were doing.
Well, of course, if they were diligent in either prosecuting the patent or diligent in commercializing the product, the fact that they did not otherwise disclose what they were working on wouldn't be enough to trigger the exception in 102G, correct?
I think that's right, but I don't think you can be diligent if your intent is to suppress and conceal.
I don't understand that. I mean, typically, if you're working, for example, on a patent, you're not going to be disclosing it to the world. You're not going to be issuing it as an article, typically, and you work on your patent quietly until you're ready to file it, and indeed the filing even doesn't get brooded about. Why is that? Assuming it's all proceeding as fast as you can, the fact that you don't disclose it doesn't trigger 102G, does it?
No. What triggers 102G is that there are acts of keeping it secret in the context of acts of keeping it secret. This means suppressing it from public knowledge. And that can happen over a short period of time or a long period of time. It does not matter.
Well, suppose, let's be concrete about this. Suppose I have an idea. I go to my patent lawyer as quickly as I can, the day after conception and reduction to practice, and I say to my patent lawyer, file this as fast as you can. I know, it takes a while to carefully draft the claims and so forth, but move as expeditiously as you can. I don't want any delay here. But in the meantime, don't you or anybody else in your firm disclose anything about this to anyone? 102G?
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily?
I don't think so.
Not at all.
I don't disagree.
As a matter of law.
I don't disagree.
So the suppression, the concealment, the non-disclosure isn't a problem in that setting as long as there's diligent progress towards disclosure, right?
And as long as there is no active proaction on behalf of the patentee to say, we are not under any circumstances, no matter whether the patent application is ready, no matter whether we get some intervening person along the line, under any circumstances are we going to file this before DATEX. That is not going to happen.
In other words, I mean, as I'm understanding from the briefs, at least, maybe in part your response to Judge Bryson's question, is you can't have established that you were proceeding diligently when what was driving this was not how long it was going to take to get to an endpoint, but the state of commercialization, the state of the neocon thing.
That.
So you're saying that the existence of that and the assumption that that was going to be the date no matter when they were ready should be sufficient to at least question whether or not there was diligence getting there? Is that,
yes.
Am I understanding
yes.
you?
Yes, and we have evidence that when their patent application was drafted in March of 1990 and presented to the inventors that they did almost nothing to it. It was ready then, and as they saw it in March, for all practical purposes, and I'm talking 98%, was what was filed the day before Neocon show.
Well, wait, but you're talking, on the patent application, you're talking about a lag between March and May, between the time it was sent to the inventors, and then in May they filed the application, right?
Yes, but they already had reduced this invention to practice as of November 1990. I mean, there are two elements of conduct that are occurring here, Your Honor. One is the progress towards the filing of a patent application, and the other is progress towards commercialization. And we submit that both of those were timed deliberately and carefully so that they were just finished just prior to the Neocon show. And it is not so much how much time lapsed, as Judge Rich has said in the Young versus Dvorkin case, as it is the totality of the conduct. Was in effect their conduct delaying the public disclosure of this? And that's what suppression and secrecy under 102G2 means, and that's the public policy behind it.
But in this case, there was diligent activity toward both preparing the application and, as I understand it, diligent activity toward commercializing this invention. And what do you see in the record that suggests that despite that reasonable conduct on both the application side and the commercialization side, suggests that this shows active suppression or concealment?
The fact that, as every single witness up there has admitted, we were doing this to time it so that it all merged and was done just before the Neocon show.
What difference does that make if all the other conduct is reasonable?
What difference it makes is that in the interim period, along comes a good faith inventor who conceives, reduces to practice, files, and makes it public.
But this could all be explained as simply a matter of shall we say, caution, even diligence on their part in coordinating both the drafting and filing of a patent application and the commercialization of the product and the disclosure and release of information at this trade show. And of course, you have in the background, you have considerations of the absolute novelty requirements for foreign filing. And I'm just having difficulty making the jump from conduct which on its face in a relatively brief period of time, we're only talking about 6 or 7 months, has all of the trappings of being nothing but reasonable to making this jump to say this is active suppression and concealment in the sense of 102G.
I'm into my rebuttal time, Your Honor, so...
What I think
distinguishes this case from any of the other cases that I have read, and I think I've read all of them from this court that deal with this, is here there are admissions by the people that they were doing this in an attempt to keep it secret and to keep it away from the public until a defined, distinguished date.
But companies do that all the time, to simply to protect their interests, not necessarily to suppress prior art or to suppress an invention.
Companies progress orderly all the time from a first unit down to the point where they either commercialize or they file an application, but not necessarily with any intent of timing when they will do it and making sure that there is deliberate denial of the public until data acts. I think that is the distinguishing factor. Thank you.
Very well. Why don't we will give you, we will restore 2 minutes of rebuttal time. Why don't we hear from Mr. Pozniak?
May it please the court. Mr. Cease has repeatedly stated that there was something other than maintaining the confidentiality of the production process and the filing and the patent preparation. In fact, nothing in the record suggests that it was anything other than normal, well, we're not going to go and tell the world about what we're filing a patent on or what we're going to disclose. There was no any particular suppression or concealment.
What difference does that make? I know that our cases have distinguished between a kind of implied suppression and express suppression, but I have been thinking about it. I was hard-pressed to see why it should make a difference, for example, in a case such as this one, whether the company simply did not disclose information about their pending patent, let's say, as opposed to one in which the company had an express policy saying don't disclose pending patent.
I don't think there is any distinction. To me, so long as there is a public disclosure within a reasonable period of time, that's the end. The statute is very simple. It just says the first inventor gets priority unless that first inventor has, quote, abandoned, suppressed, or concealed, unquote. If you have a public disclosure within a reasonable time, however that disclosure is made, that's the end of the story.
But isn't a reasonable time based on the facts and based on various facts and circumstances?
It is.
I mean, there's no rule 3 months is not enough and 8 months.
Oh. Well, that's correct.
Why isn't that? I mean, I understand the question. It's a question of law, the ultimate question of whether or not there was suppression concealment. But why isn't that a matter that should have gone to the jury to determine the reasonableness or the facts, you know, the inferences to be taken from the facts and circumstances given?
It's a question whether it should ever go to a jury under any circumstances. As the Pollock case by this court and Bach has held, whether something is suppressed or concealed is dependent on the public policy.
Well, but that case, I think we can all agree, doesn't hold that this is not a jury question. No, you're really stretching, I think, from the public policy that is based in principles of equity to say that this is not a jury issue. And indeed, although neither I nor I take it Mr. Cease could find a case from this court which specifically held that this issue is a jury issue, we've certainly had many cases in which it has been submitted to a jury and in which we have effectively said the jury correctly or incorrectly adjudicated this issue. I mean, I think you have a real uphill battle to try to persuade us that that in-bank case, which doesn't hold anything about whether it's a jury question or not, should be read to say that this is not a jury question when it is, as Judge Prost says, so heavily factual in its nature.
I'll then continue with the other argument, which is...
I mean, do you have anything else? Is that it? Your in-bank case for this proposition that doesn't go to the jury?
I believe that if you are talking about equitable issues have normally, such as inequitable conduct, have been held triable to the court rather than to a jury. In this case, in any event, there are no disputed issues. The facts are that, yes, there was a reduction to practice in November 16, and there was a public disclosure within 7 months. The disclosure was at a once-a-year international trade show, which is the place where anyone who has any new product tries to display it.
You mean there are no disputes about the historical facts?
That's correct.
But that doesn't take a case away from a jury, right? I mean, if you have a negligence case, it may be that no one disagrees about what happened at the corner, at the intersection where the accident occurred, but it's the jury's job to decide, based on its assessment of the historical facts in light of the instructions it's given, as to whether those facts arise to the level of negligence. Isn't that exactly the situation here?
No, sir, because there will be certain historical facts under which no court and no reasonable jury could find negligence.
Sure, but the fact that there's no disagreement as to the historical facts is not in and of itself enough to take a case away from a jury, correct?
Well, yes, but what we're saying is that, first of all, there are no triable facts. And given the undisputed facts, everything is controlled by this court's precedent. This court's precedent in both the Checkpoint case and the Dow Chemical cases have been very clear that, respectively, 4 years and 3 years of time taken between reduction to practice and commercialization is not abandoned suppression or concealment. You cannot square those two holdings with any possibility of giving a case to a jury to suggest that a 7 months of diligent effort toward commercialization can constitute abandonment, suppression, or concealment.
Now, those cases said, if I recall correctly, correct me if I'm wrong, but that 4 years or 3 years was not, as a matter of law, concealment.
That's correct.
Which is quite different from saying that anything less than 4 or 3 years, as a matter of law, is not concealment.
That's right, but I think it's up
so
to the...
So to say that, well, there you are, 3 or 4 years is the line, that's just not correct, right?
Well, it certainly says that in those cases, what the courts held was that up to 4 years of diligent efforts toward commercialization negates suppression or concealment.
But you're not arguing that as a matter of law. You're simply saying that if a jury had found that wasn't suppression, that the appellate court wouldn't overturn that jury finding as a matter of law. That's all those cases stand for.
I do not see how a jury on these facts could make a determination under the law that the 7 months of undisputed diligence constituted suppression or concealment. You're permitting the jury to find something that, as a matter of law, cannot be a correct result. There's no precedent at all in any of this court's or the predecessor court's decisions that would suggest that 7 months of diligent effort constitutes, can constitute suppression or concealment. When you have cases that say 3 or 4 years of diligent effort, it does not constitute abandonment or concealment. How can 7 months be? You're essentially
just... But you're suggesting that there's no dispute as to whether or not there was reasonable diligent effort from November till June? And it's, isn't that a matter that, I mean, the other side is disputing?
That was never disputed, Your Honor. There was never any dispute that the effort was diligent. The efforts were stated, that there was no cross-examination. The tooling to get a product that had the features, you know, that had the aesthetics and everything else that could be done, some of that tooling was took 24 weeks. That's 6 months. Mr. Ambrose, the inventor himself, testified that he thought 6 months to a year was a reasonable period, and that's cited in our brief.
Mr. Pozniak, could you comment a bit about your position on inequitable conduct?
Yes, Your Honor. It is, Your Honor, and somewhat unusual to ask this court to reverse the decision of the trial court on inequitable conduct, but this court has done it before, finding inequitable conduct as a matter of law, even where the district court has found no inequitable conduct.
What are the best authorities for that proposition, where this court has actually directed the entry of judgment of inequitable conduct over a trial judge's finding of no inequitable conduct?
I would cite, Your Honor, Criticon versus Becton Dickinson, 120 F3rd, 1253.
Okay.
Federal Circuit, 1997.
Anything else?
Pardon?
Anything else that you found in your research?
It's certainly, the best case.
Any other not so good cases, but still support you?
I do not. Off the top of my head, I cannot recall another case where there has been an actual entry of judgment,
okay,
as opposed to sending it back to the court.
Okay.
But the reason that the court should act in this fashion in this case is, again, the record doesn't show any dispute as to any material facts. What happened is fairly well clear. There are certain inferences from the facts, but those inferences are not really issues of credibility. This is a case where everything was done by an attorney. We're not saying the inventor or someone else knew something and did not do something. It's all, everyone says it's the was the attorney's decision.
You had a deposition from Mr. Fox,
yes,
the attorney in question, which you introduced.
That's correct.
At a trial. You didn't call Mr. Fox. Was that because?
We could not call him because.
Outside of the jurisdiction.
Outside the jurisdiction.
So did you try to subpoena him or? Was it just clear that he wasn't?
It was clear that he was not going to show up.
Okay. All right.
And we couldn't subpoena him if the other side wanted to bring him in. Obviously, I'm sure he would have.
Okay.
This all centers around the failure to disclose this Jones letter and the attached photographs.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Now, is it your position that that information is material?
Your Honor, I think it is the highest form of materiality, because what that letter showed, and not so much the letter, but the photographs that were attached to the letter.
And the letter, I mean, you could characterize the letter as attorney argument. It's not evidence.
That's correct, but
the photographs were not dated.
That's correct, Your Honor. But the photo, what Mr. Jones from said in that letter is, these are photographs of something that was on sale in 1989.
No, that's his argument. Why is that material?
Well,
let's suppose that hypothetically now, this is not this case, but hypothetically, let's suppose that there was no Siler patent, and the only information that came to light was the Jones letter and the photographs. Did Mr. Fox have a duty to disclose that information?
Absolutely, because the fact that it's a letter and photographs does not change the fact that this is prior art. These are
photographs. Well, that's the question.
Well, it is photographs of the prior art. It is no different than, for example, a brochure.
And in fact, that information was disclosed by different counsel in the 231 file.
That's correct. That counsel saw it and said, I'd better disclose it.
And he disclosed it, made no representation as to the veracity of the information, and the examiner even questioned counsel. Did you follow up? Did you examine this equipment? And the response, as I understand it, is that no, we didn't follow up. We make no representations one way or the other. We make no admissions. You know what I know. That take it from there. And the Patent Office dropped it.
In that case, that particular examiner dropped it, and the claims were different than the claims in the 489 patent.
Yeah.
In the 489 patent, what was shown in those photographs was anticipatory. It is the highest form of materiality. If you say, well, this was a representation by another attorney that this was a picture of the prior art, and the attorney says, well, I didn't believe it. Well,
that is what he said.
Yeah, I didn't believe it. But there was no objective basis for him not to believe it. It was the product was offered for his inspection.
Well, he says he had an objective basis not to believe it because this was an argument from an attorney representing a party who had been charged with infringing or potentially infringing this patent.
No, that's not correct, Your Honor. The other party was in licensing negotiations. They weren't doing anything yet. They were going to take a license under these patents. Penny and Edmonds was asked to make an investigation, did an investigation, and told the potential licensee, don't take a license under this because they're not certified.
Go ahead.
Nonetheless, it's a potential adverse party.
Where would you normally expect to find prior art? You would expect someone with an interest in the matter to investigate the history and the prior art, and if a piece of prior art is presented to you, it is presented.
Well, yeah, but you might well expect that person would be presenting something in the spirit of advocacy where the interest of their client was to say that your patent is valueless, I don't have to take a license.
Well, what if the other attorney presented a brochure that had a date on it?
Therein lies the distinction.
And I would say, why would that be any different?
Well, it's different because it has evidentiary weight. And similarly, the attorney could have submitted an affidavit from somebody to verify the photographs. How do we know that machine represented or argued in the letter wasn't built the day before the letter was sent?
In the decision by Mr. Fox should have been to disclose the information unless he had clear evidence of some sort that what was represented to him was not true or was incorrect.
Let me turn the question just a little bit, not to interrupt, but let's suppose Mr. Fox had submitted this information, just as it was done in the other patent by different counsel, and the examiner in that case questioned the evidence. Did you go verify it? Did you have a date? And let's suppose that Mr. Fox had made the same statement. You now know everything I know, and I'm not making any admissions. It is what it is. What is the examiner to do with that? Would the examiner have properly rejected a claim on the basis of that information?
And I believe that the examiner could have, because an examiner can accept hearsay information in the course of the prosecution. Moreover, even if the examiner chose not to pursue it and said, okay, well, I don't have enough information to convince me, that information would have been in the file so that a third party, a member of the public, who was faced with that patent, already had the necessary information to determine whether or not they should be taking a license under the patent or respecting the patent to avoid infringement or deciding to challenge the validity of the patent. That information in the public record is relevant not only for the purposes of the examination, but it is relevant and material in the sense that it creates a body of information that can be utilized.
Is that the standard of materiality under Rule 56?
No, the rule is that materiality is what would be considered important by an examiner. And in this case, I think it would be considered important by an examiner as evidenced by what happened in the other case. The examiner in the other case then ignored the information. He asked for more information and then decided in that case not to pursue it. But again, it was a different set of claims.
Really different, yeah.
The Ergo device, which is the depicted device in the photograph that we've been talking about, I take it, that was introduced at trial as itself prior art, correct? Setting aside the inequitable conduct issue.
Yes.
And what was the argument that was made as to why that was not anticipating prior art?
And because the court had construed, I'm sorry, the 489
right.
claims required a clamp, and that ergo prior art had a flat, sticky surface, did not have a clamp.
Right.
It was therefore utilized in combination with other elements to show obviousness, and the jury did find obviousness. So, but in the prosecution, you have to give claims their broadest scope. That's in Rule 56 and in other rules. And in this case, counsel for Ambrose had argued that a flat surface, i.e. exactly what is in the Ergo device, did constitute a clamp. That was the request that they had made during the claim construction hearing. The Judge McKeague did not agree with them, but the argument was made that
lucky for them.
Well, it's
as it turns out.
Yes, it was. Because otherwise, if Ambrose, FlexRest had won its Markman construction, then that device would have been anticipatory. But more importantly, Mr. Fox, and this is cited in our brief, Mr. Fox believed that a flat surface did constitute a clamp. So he, looking at that photograph, saw an anticipatory prior art, assuming it was prior art, and he had no reason to believe that it was not prior art.
Very well. Why don't we hear from Mr. Keith, and we will reserve, your rebuttal time. Mr. Cease and Mr. Neal, if you could add an extra 5 minutes to Mr. Cease's time in light of the time we spent with Mr. Pazuniak. Mr. Cease.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me address the inequitable conduct issue first. I think there's no better answer as to why there's no inequitable conduct than Judge McKee's March 23rd, 2005 opinion. There were three assertions of inequitable conduct made by Steelcase. One was the photographs and the Harry Jones letter. The second was they said it was inequitable conduct not to disclose the KBS. When Mr. Ambrose found out about the KBS at the Neocon show and was in the middle of prosecution of his application. And the third was he said he filed a false declaration in his petition to make special the refiled application. What Mr. Fox did, I think, needs to be viewed in the light of what Mr. Fox knew. Mr. Fox was called, asked to go along with Mr. Ambrose to a meeting at the Boston Logan Airport and discuss what they believed was going to be the final signing of a license agreement with Webernet. Instead, what they were confronted with was the Penny Edmonds letter, told about the Siler patent, and presented this letter. Actually, the letter wasn't presented at that time. They went home, and then they confirmed the meeting, sent the letter, sent the photographs days afterwards. No dates on the photographs. The letter was sent by somebody who obviously had a biased position, namely, we don't want our client to have to pay any money and take a license. And so he had a right to challenge and the credibility of it, recognizing that it was coming from a biased person. And Judge McKee distinguished, there's no citation of the case that Mr. Zuniak gave you, Crittenden, I believe, in his briefing. The case he relied upon was Brasselier. The case he relied upon at the district court level, and he relied upon it here. And Judge McKee distinguished Brasselier very nicely, saying, in that case, you have a senior lawyer at the company, in effect, being in cahoots with the client, both of them knowing that a prior public use had occurred, and so they assigned the drafting of a patent application to a junior lawyer, telling him he's got 3 days to beat a bar date, and that's why he's got to file in a hurry. And he did file in a hurry. Everything turned south, and ultimately there was inequitable conduct. And what Judge McKeague said was a singularly distinguishing feature from that Brasselier case about the information, was that the lawyer here had total access to the information from his own client. All he had to do was go talk to his client, the people that he was dealing with in-house, and they could have known all the necessary facts about the prior public use. And here, we did not only not have access to the information from our own client, in fact, we had skepticism about whether the information was really accurate.
And but you know, that information was received, that letter was received in, was it, May
of
96?
Yes.
And then a few months later, in October, there was an information disclosure statement submitted.
Yes.
And that idea, and at the same time, there was a petition to make special.
Yes.
And the information disclosure statement, for the first time, made this Siler patent of record.
Yes, and I think it is important to note what Mr. Fox did. He had a loud case when he went to that Boston airport and talked to those folks. And when he found out about the Siler patent, he went back, refiled, opened his record, and put the Siler patent in the record.
So he obviously recognized this was important enough to bring to the attention of the patent office, at least insofar as the Siler patent was concerned.
And Mr. Siler himself, Your Honor, testified that the patent taught more than the photographs did.
But here's the concern I have, because the representation made to the patent office in the information disclosure statement is that Siler shows a keyboard platform always positioned in a positive tilt. Says it appears to have some limit switches, and the configuration of the gearing always positions the keyboard in a positive tilt. There is no teaching of positioning the keyboard in a negative tilt position. But yet you have this photograph that was attached to the Jones letter that shows the keyboard in exactly the negative tilt that was the subject of the claims of this patent. So you have information which is hardly cumulative. It's directly contradictory to the statements that were made. And doesn't that make that at least a matter of interest for the examiner?
Well, the testimony of Mr. Fox was that he and Mr. Ambrose had studied the Siler reference, and that they believed that as it was moving up and down, that it was always maintained in a level position, that they'd gone through the mechanics of it, and that is what they believed. His testimony about the photographs was that he was highly doubtful about their credibility and about the machine and whether it had been altered or nothing. He knew nothing about it, and for that reason, he simply did not disclose it.
Well, if you read the Siler reference, it shows there are figures there that show movement in a clockwise and counterclockwise direction for the keyboard, and it discloses these limit switches, but there's nothing that clearly, one way or the other, says that it only moves in horizontal or positive position. And I understand from an advocate's point of view that was the posture that Mr. Fox wanted to take, but you have these photographs that seem to directly contradict that position. Don't you think the examiner might have taken a little different look at the Seiler reference if that information in the Jones letter and the photographs had been shared with him?
Well, what I can say is that he gave him the Seiler reference. The examiner had the Seiler reference to interpret as he or she wished. Mr. Fox, I believe, told them what he thought was the truth about the Seiler reference. And I might remind the court that Judge McKeague said that there was no evidence that he could conclude gave rise to intent to deceive based upon the conduct of Mr. Fox. Perhaps negligent, but certainly no intent to deceive.
I have read the Fox deposition, and it's true, as you say, that Mr. Fox defended in substantial measure on the ground that he just didn't regard the photographs as essentially credible.
Yes.
But he doesn't really say much about why he reached that conclusion, and I'd be interested in whether there's any basis, other than the fact that it happens to have come from somebody that was engaged in licensing negotiations, and therefore to that extent perhaps an adverse party. But there was a representation by reputable lawyers that this photograph depicted something that was in existence prior to the priority date of the patent. So it's not clear to me wherein he got his skepticism about the photograph.
I believe that his testimony was that his skepticism came from he thought they were being set up at the Logan Airport meeting, so to speak, by a biased group of individuals, and the photographs had no dates on them. There was no authentication on the photographs as to whether that was the device that existed at an earlier period of time or whether it was a device that had been altered in the
time.
Well,
there was a representation by the lawyers that
was
so.
There was.
So he's basically saying, I believe these lawyers were lying to me. But on what ground? I mean, we don't ordinarily assume one of our fellow counsel is lying unless we have no basis whatsoever, right?
I believe that his testimony for his reason was simply that it was from a biased person who he believed didn't want to pay any money under a license. That's what I think the record establishes.
The petition to make special represented that he had conducted a thorough search.
Yes.
Does that place an obligation on him to take the step to check out this information received in the Jones letter to determine definitively whether it was or was not accurate? Or
well, that is going farther than a search. That's that's almost a detective-like investigation, and that's a different concept than the standard boilerplate language that says in a petition to make special, I've ran a search.
If you do a search and you find a piece of literature in a library that looks like it's a dead ringer, but the date is obscured, is that enough? You just say, well, it's got no date on it, so don't have to worry about that. And you represent under oath to the patent office in order to have the patent application considered special that you've conducted a careful and thorough search. Don't you have some obligation to find that date?
What gives rise to a duty to investigate for a prosecuting attorney is at best, I think, fuzzily defined by the cases as to when you have sufficient information and access to sufficient information that you have to go that extra step. I don't think that there is sufficient information that was here. Given the circumstance under which he got the letter, I think, as Judge McKeague distinguished the Brasseler case, I think he was correct. I would like to
Let me ask just Judge Lynn's question, and let me put it in a slightly different way, but I think it's the same question. I mean, you're an experienced patent lawyer. If a junior associate in your firm came to you and had this exact case and was holding that letter and that photograph and said, Mr. Cease, I just received this. We have an application pending. Should I disclose this to the patent office? What would you tell that associate to do?
I would tell him exactly what I told the class I teach at Drake University. Disclose all.
Okay.
Why take a chance? Disclose all.
But, of course, you would add that that doesn't mean that the failure to disclose has the consequences that your opponent
exactly.
counsel urged.
Right. I want to mention one thing and then I will sit down. I think it's critically important to the entire analysis of this and the consequences of the KBS to note that in the inequitable conduct proceeding after the trial was over, in response to the question about whether he should have disclosed the KBS, Judge McKeague said, KBS is not prior art at all. Well, if the KBS is not prior art at all, the KBS should not have been in presence of the jury. It was information kept secret, information that Mr. Ambrose had no access to, information that the public had no access to. And that kind of information has to be extraordinary circumstances in order for that to be prior art in any litigation. Thank you.
Did you have a question? Any other questions? Very well, thank you. Mr. Pazuniak, third rebuttal or second rebuttal?
If I may...
This is limited just to the cross-appeal, Mr. Yes.
If I may, just to follow up on the court's questions about another case, I perhaps should cite one other decision, and that is the Bruno Independent Living Aids versus Acorn case, 394 F3rd 1348 at 1354. Although it's not directly relevant to the court's question, in that case, this court was in the course of discussing the finding of intent, said as follows, the particular facts and circumstances of the present case correspond in all relevant aspects to those cases in which we have upheld inferential findings of deceptive intent on similar key evidence, unquote. So in that case, this court was saying, yes, we can infer intent to deceive because if you look at the facts, they correspond completely to the types of facts on which we have found or inferred inequitable intent in the past. And that is exactly, I think, this case. If you look at the objective facts, just the plain objective facts, the very issues Your Honors have picked up in the questions, you have to say on what possible basis could anyone legitimately have withheld those photographs and the potential prior art. In this case, in fact, is worse than in most other cases because there was a petition to make special and a declaration by the attorney. That attorney declaration said clearly and unequivocally, I have conducted a prior art search. With that declaration, he submitted the Seiler patent and all the other pieces of prior art that were in the IDS. In effect, he was telling the patent office, hey, don't bother doing anything else. Here's my oath, here's my representation that I have done the prior art search. Here's all the prior art, now grant the petition to make special, which was granted. Once the attorney made that representation that I have done a search of the prior art, he is no longer in a position to simply take a piece of prior art, or potential prior art, the photographs in this case, and simply say, I don't believe it. He has now represented that he has made an investigation, and he either has to make an investigation or make a disclosure, but he cannot do it either. That is why we cited the Brasselier case. because it did stand for the proposition that in certain circumstances, yes, you are under an obligation to conduct a further search. And that, obviously, the facts in Brasilier are different, and we never said they were identical, but the proposition in Brasilier remains valid even today, which is you have to, if you, under certain circumstances, you have to make an investigation. And in this case, when the attorney said he made an investigation and he did not, then that was, he lied, a plain out lie to the patent office. In addition to just withholding that piece of prior art. And if we accept the attorney's...
Well, I guess that really depends. I mean, lie is a strong word, and I think that it depends on the scope of what he conceives as the responsibility to investigate. I mean, if this had been, if somebody had said at the airport, and oh, by the way, we have machines that do this sort of thing, I wonder whether you would be arguing, well, there you are. Somebody had made a passing reference orally, and therefore his failure to pursue that constituted, made his representation to the patent office a lie. I don't think you would.
No, I apologize. Maybe it's a little too strong a word, but I don't think it's far from the truth. Because if you are representing that you have made an investigation, with that representation to the patent office comes certain baggage. And that baggage is that you do have to accept your own words as the governing conduct. And in this case, what you have is an attorney who has, from a reputable source, a clear indication of prior art, and simply does not ask any more questions, does not accept the invitation to inspect the device or to send his inventors over to inspect the device, just suppresses that information. And if we accept that as the relevant standard, that someone can simply avoid prior art because subjectively without any objective basis, but subjectively only, he did not believe it, I think we have set then the standard for attorney's conduct before the PTO far, far too low. Because anyone would be able to say that, well, I didn't believe this, I didn't believe that.
Very well. I think we've gone well over our time. Let me ask you one procedural question, just in terms of the posture of your cross-appeal. I won't assume, I'll just ask. This is not a conditional cross-appeal. I take it this is a cross-appeal which you would press regardless of the disposition of the main appeal.
Is that correct?
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Case is submitted. Thank both counsel.